Welcome back to the Everyday Endurance Podcast, a podcast for everyday people who want to do extraordinary things really slowly and still make it to work on Monday. I'm your host, Simon Perrottin, and as usual, I'm joined by my brother, Luke Perrottin.
Hello, everyone. On this show, we talk about training for and competing in endurance events and how to balance endurance training with work and family life. So on this episode, we're going to talk about a funny topic. Training and restraining is the episode title we've come up with. So Simon, we know what training is. What's restraining? What led us to this?
Well, it relates back to a bit of a story of destruction. Shout out to Andrew Kirkby enjoys a good bit of yourself and I putting ourselves in unnecessary pain. Our story starts the week before an endurance event last year when in the taper period, I was feeling fit, feeling good, just feeling really good about life. And that's what we're going for sometimes with these. So my chosen workout for that weekend was to go out and do exactly the same 40 kilometer time trial on the road bike as would be done in the event the next weekend. So not surprisingly, performance was somewhat better in the detraining weekend the week before than the next week when I went in there with my calf muscles and other muscles bound up nice and tight. That would bring us into our topic of restraining.
It puts us firmly in the territory of restraining. So we've got some stories that are going to resonate with everyday endurance athletes where sometimes you're training suboptimal, sometimes you do it wrong. But there's always a good spirit. You're always trying to get to the starting line and healthy and well. And when you're not trained, there's a saying, you know, if you're not ready, be rested. I've probably paraphrased that. The meaning is there for you. I probably paraphrased that in a confusing way, but the importance of being both rested and ready. But if you're not quite ready, make sure you're rested. And that was my approach for the Yu Yangs 50K that I got through.
Right. So let's
week
let's
and hear, a half ago.
Let's hear the race report. Let's get into it. So Yu Yangs located just sort of southwest of Melbourne in Victoria.
It sure is. Yeah.
National park in there, is it?
It's actually not even a state park. It's you can bring dogs along to the Yu Yangs, I've discovered.
Right.
I'm not sure if it's a state park or what it is. It's not a national park. So it's sort of an open access area for mountain bikers and hikers and people bringing their dogs. And it's sort of a rocky outcroppy area. It's sort of exposed, but for some reason, at least every time I've been there, it seems to have really bad weather forecast for the Melbourne area. And then all the rain goes over the mountains just above it and seems to miss the Yu Yangs. It seems to have its different weather in that area because of the way the weather fronts go over Melbourne. But it was either that or I've had a lot of good luck. And it was a cold day, but really nice weather, 3 drops of rain for the whole day. And just before, so with this event, so it's run by Brett Saxon and the Trails Plus crew down there, and they put it on for, must have been, it's over a decade of continuous running of this event. And I love it. It's good fun. They run a hardcore 100 miler, I call it. So it's multiple laps of the Yu Yangs Park, State Park. And it's just amazing watching people. So you go there and do your event. I did the 50 kilometers on the Sunday and the clock's running there. And we took off at the 24 hour mark. So the clock doesn't say zero, it says 24 hours and you take off and there's people still out there on the track and you go and overtake them on your loop. It's amazing. And you see, I didn't get to see the people who are coming in winning it because I'd start at the 24 hour mark and people are still out looping. So just hats off to them for their efforts.
Such
a massive effort.
How far is the loop?
So, 100 miles. They have 100 kilometers as well. And they used to have an 80 kilometers or an 80 mile, 50 miler and a 50K, but now just a 50K and I think a marathon distance. If I've got this wrong, I'm sorry. Marathon distance, I think a half marathon and a 15K. So all these different events for different abilities. So if you're a bit detrained, that could be a part of our title as well, training and detraining and restraining and hopefully not too much restraining. But if you're if you're not quite ready for a bigger distance, you can jump in and do a shorter distance. I think I've done it four times now, the 50K. Something about it I just keep coming back to. It seems to be the perfect distance for me at that stage of the year.
And have you got,
it's good fun.
In terms of aid stations, in terms of support, is it just a one point at the start where you come back to? And so you just run around your 50?
The other people to shout out is the volunteers for these events, because they're just anyone that's done an endurance event will have met volunteers who've come there and given up their time, and they're doing aid station work or, you know, directing traffic, marshal work. It's really important work. It's making sure the runners don't get lost or just being there in case something goes wrong. So they're all out there in a few different aid stations, but it's a cloverleaf sort of shape. So there's Pyramid Peak, which is on the other side of the bay to where we live, and I can see it from where we go to the beach all the time. And then this event goes up Pyramid Peak three times. I think the 100 miler event, they do eight loops. So they go up at eight times. And it's not that much of a mountain, but it adds up over the course of the event. So it's sort of a cloverleaf shape. You go up Pyramid Peak and then around it, then around the other side. Then you do a big loop around the park and do that a couple of times. And it adds up to 50 kilometers. It's good fun.
And was there a highlight of that run?
Oh, finishing.
Surviving.
This is the level of the field you're hearing from here. So you've got your, if you want to hear Killian Jornet or Lucy Bartholomew or somebody talk about what it's like to go fast, you can find them, search for them. But there's a lot of people just like us who are really proud of finishing events.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was tough.
Because what was the low light then?
So this is our theme here, training. And not enough training sometimes is the reality. And sometimes there's a time when you want to pull out of things, isn't there? When you're going to make it unsafe for yourself or other people, or you can have a miserable experience. But there's a point when you haven't trained quite enough, but you know, you're not going to do the same time you did last year, but it is still worth doing that event. So as long as I come in within the cutoff and not delaying anybody or causing any safety issues, go ahead and do it, right? But I knew it was going to be a tough day. So I paired up with a guy who I met on the track. Michael was his name. Shout out to Michael. And we had a really good conversation. We did the whole thing. I shudder to admit my finishing time here, or our finishing time. We used up all the available time we had out there. And I even took poles. Some people are anti-poles. Some people love them. They tend to be something that the people near the back of the run will use more commonly, but I ran with poles for the whole event.
Is there much mandatory gear for that one?
It's common sense. So there's suggested gear that's not mandated. So in the longer ultra events, you have to mandate gear like snake bandages, waterproof jackets, certain amount of minimal food, water capacity, and things like that. You just have to get the permits. My understanding from the race directors is they have to, you know, in order to get a permit, if something goes wrong in an ultra event, it can cause all sorts of havoc for everybody. And no one wants anyone to come to any harm. So they sort of have to over prepare and make sure everyone takes mandatory gear. And I really don't hear too many complaints about that. You just do it. It's a part of the race. And then I don't know anyone who's cheated on mandatory gear. I'm sure it happens, but all the people I've done them with happily go for the lightest jacket you can, but it's got to pass the pre-race check-in as well. I don't really see people trying to cheat that. But
one of the more interesting pieces of mandatory gear that yourself and I have had to carry was the snake bite bandage on the kayak leg of the Gippsland Challenge. Speaking of Gippsland, shout out to Big Cole, who said he's going to listen in on the tractor.
G'day, Cole. One.
Big Cole in Gippsland. So
to Gippsland's to the east of Melbourne, for those who are not in Victoria or Melbourne. So
the Gippsland Lakes. And at the bar the night before, when I spoke to one of the other competitors or the race organizer, they said, yeah, actually the snakes, they swim out to the island. So you can come across a tiger snake in the middle of your kayak leg, and it may even try and get into your boat. So I said, give me a second snake bite kit, please. I don't like the sound of being in a kayak and having one of the world's most deadly or venomous snake. I'm not sure which one it is. Come along and try and get inside the boat with me. Although I guess with a paddle, you'd be trying to you'd at least be able to try and flick it away or something.
Fend it off. I had a close call with a tiger snake on the Great Ocean Walk run. So it's a funny name. So the Great Ocean Walk is the name of the 100-kilometer trail, and there's an annual run, which we call the Gow. And I think I was in the second half of the race, and there was a tiger snake on the track, sunbaking, had no interest in moving, and it was a bit of a standoff, and I wasn't going close to it, but I had my poles there, and I felt better with the poles, and then it wouldn't move, and I was standing here for over a minute. Eventually, I just got the poles and did, smashed them on the ground and made some vibrations. And it didn't like that, and it left. I was nowhere near the snake. It's 10 meters away from it.
Very, very angry sort of snake, though, isn't it?
They'll attack you, tigers. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm. And then there was lots of browns as well. So brown snakes. So we've got all the most deadly snakes in the world in terms of their venom.
Less of them in Tassie, but unfortunately the ones we've got, I believe, are still deadly. We've got tiger snakes, one of the main ones you see, and copperheads and other snakes. There's a rumor that there's a what I'm told now is an urban myth, but I was always told there's only three types of snakes in Tasmania, but someone else has told me recently that that's an urban myth. So something I might Google when we jump off this, see how many snakes are out there.
I know two people that have been bitten by snakes on Australian trail ultra runs. I won't name them. But they've told me the stories, and they've both been dry bites, which is the term for when the snake says get away from me, but doesn't get a chance to put the venom in. So they've had snake teeth in them and had minor problems, nothing permanent. And obviously did all the full snake bite routine of staying still and not moving the part, calling for help. That's why you run with others and you have a beacon or a phone that has reception, and obviously a couple of snake bandages on the limb, but it's pretty rare. To know two different people that have had a snake bite is rare. It's not like it happens every day.
Being Australian, and being active and doing lots of camping and hiking through school, a lot of people like us have done snake bite training and know how to do a snake biting. One thing I didn't pick up during that I picked up during the advanced emergency care ski patrol training to be a volunteer up there on our local peak, Ben Lomond. There is snow in Tasmania, if anyone wants to know, was to mark out on top of your bandages as you've come through and done your snake bite bandages, which you can quite easily Google how to do, if you've forgotten, you never panic the snake bite part, but was to, have that marker pen and mark out the point where close to where you believe the bite is, so that obviously when you get to the emergency department or whatever, should they need to keep the rest of the bandage on, but they want to, inspect the bite or something like that, they can remove just that bit of dressing and not release the venom further into it, is how it's explained to me.
So you wrap from the top of the limb down to the toes, or from the shoulder down to the hand, from memory?
It's something you probably should look up on the Google.
It's probably don't just listen to some podcast and then copy us.
Just out of interest, and it's not medical advice, but just out of interest, that was one thing they said. So, following what trained first aiders would teach you how to do it, during that process at the end, that was another tip I saw, was to kind of make sure there's some ability to know where the actual bite itself is. I'd never heard that through all our training at school and scouts and everything else that people do. So that's something.
But having a death from a snake bite is really rare because of all the medical treatment. It's just more a matter of staying still and getting the help and bandaging them up.
So not pushing on with the next 50 kilometers.
Probably. I don't know. This is the mentality of ultra endurance events. Hopefully there's a point there where, you've pushed yourself. You said, okay, I'm willing to I'm not fully trained for this event. I'm willing to not finish as quickly as I did last year, for example. I'm going to do this. Be happy with it. And there's a point where if a snake bite is an obvious one, or potentially an injury or changes in your kidneys and your hydration. So for example, dark urine is a red flag for things that are going wrong with your kidneys and just things like that. There's a point where you stop and go, okay, enough's enough. I'm not going to hurt myself. Because as hard as that was at the Yuyangs, and I wasn't optimally trained, I knew it was all within a sensible for an endurance person, within a sensible sort of bubble of what I could tolerate, and I recovered fine. It's just knowing where that point is where you've taken it too far, isn't it?
Yeah, a snake bite's an easy, as you say. I've got bitten by a snake. It's lightning. That's all of these are fair excuses.
But lightning's a good one though, because people go and people behave in a crazy way around lightning. Oh, it won't happen to me, and they head out there. And there's often people out in lightning storms.
Yeah,
terrible idea.
You and I have been stuck in one, two that I can think of, which were in high alpine areas and a lot of other endurance.
We were in the lightning position, so boots on the ground as low as you can get. We got surprised, pinned down by a fast-moving storm cell. We're up in a high exposed area away from with the highest point. So this is in the Australian Alps. There are Alps in Australia. It's not the Alps. They're just the big spread out high country of Australia with lots of rolling hills. We're on that. We're pinned out away from shelter. Do you remember that? Do you remember when that cloud went over and the hail was going over us, and then it started to change from sort of rain to hail, and that last bit of when it really started to hail, it almost like big snowballs. Do you remember them?
Lying in frozen mud, getting heavy hail.
We're just looking at each other and just
hoping you don't get struck by lightning.
Well, the lightning and the thunder were arriving at the same time. There was no count to seven. It was just like the movies. You remember that? It was the top of us.
Yep. Right in the middle of it. And that can happen so quickly in the mountains, and definitely.
And we got the hell out of there, and then we just left our packs and ran down to a safer area.
In terms, I suppose lightning is a real world example in terms of our topic and holding back and training. As amateur endurance people, we are balancing work and family, these things, and then returning to our sport. And when we do it as the same as probably the pros, but we'll often, there'll be times when we have had our ideal preparation and other times not. And other times you might have lacked some sleep or had a really stressful period. And when you're doing, you can't control lightning turning up. You can try and control a snake biting you, but you can get unlucky. But you will have at times when you're doing, an event, could be your local 10K or whatever. And when you're doing those, you are pushing your heart rate to a higher limit. You're pushing your joints and connecting tissues to a point of stress. With experience of doing an event, I think probably people would build up, an understanding of what feels right and what doesn't. Mm. But, in terms of your comments about when do you hold back, I suppose for me, obviously I have a family and I want to return. They're the number one priority, not to totally write yourself off in some event. So if I'm doing a mountain bike or something like that, it's a family are first. I will take a level of risk. I'm not risk averse. You wouldn't be out there if you were, but at this stage, there's dependence and everything has to be slightly, canvassed on particularly when you come through as a mid-packer, the difference that, a life-threatening risk might be for you if you started to, the stories in ultra and endurance and things like that are your Goggins and Rich Rolls and these people, and stories coming out of America about people peeing blood and continuing and this sort of stuff. Mm. And I guess it's probably, they did that sort of stuff and survived. You might not. That's the thing. That's the reason they're telling you that story. There's also poetic license in some of these things. These individuals, but if you are asking me to write a book about the endurance event, I'm going to have to use drama I'm going to have to highlight certain aspects of it to get the attention.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, but look, this is back to my Yu Yang's race report. Yeah, my big toenails were both attached on both feet. Feet were good. I'm a big fan of getting the right socks, experiment with those, and the right shoes. The days of having just one shoe width are behind us. So people like us with a wide foot, can rejoice. We can choose the extra wide size shoe and avoid all those side blisters of the feet and everything. And there's lots of Vaseline on the toes before you start and everything. But feet were good. It was just, I wasn't going fast enough to get blisters, I'll tell you that. But I was really proud of our performance. So we kept up a really good spirit. And as the inevitable fatigue came on in the last 10 kilometers, so I hadn't done enough training for that event, but there it is. What I noticed was I really just lost power as expected in the calf muscles and glutes. So you sort of have to change your technique. And I took poles the whole way. So poles are awesome going up hills and sometimes really good for stability coming down the hills when you're tired. But I was just using the poles to push along on the flat, like a cross country skier, just to assist the running speed. I know that's a bit unorthodox.
Yeah.
But why not? I'm not going to carry them in my hands, or
you've got them there anyway. Exactly.
Push along with the poles. And that helps because you lose a lot of your power in your calf as you're really fatigued.
Yeah. My understanding is in Europe, it's the thing, isn't it? It's often used and polarizing for ultra people who, you know, something's polarizing for everybody in the world, isn't it? There's always someone who doesn't.
Oh, Europe's a very different place. It's a funny thing to say. I took poles around the Yuyang's 50 trail, but others did it as well. You just don't put your ego aside and say, what do I need for today? Now, I've never used them there before, but that's what I felt I needed, and they were really helpful. And the other thing is that on the nutrition side of things is just obviously having a nutrition plan. I find towards the end, no matter how good my nutrition has been. So my plan is I base it on half hour segments. I think a lot of people do this. And I say every half an hour, I'm checking in with, you know, what I've done in the last half an hour and trying to adjust. And obviously you don't carry 4 liters of water or whatever with you for the whole race. You come in and refill bottles and you have a bit of a plan. And I just find no matter how tasty the food is or the liquids are at the beginning and you can't get enough and all this is good, I just find it so hard to eat or drink anything in the last, when you're really fatigued. There must be a brain central fatigue element to that as well, where you're just ready for rest. You're not ready. Everything's fatigued, including your digestive system and your neurons, your brain and everything. And I know, just can't even eat a snake or, you know, a jelly snake, tube snake, or a bit of chocolate. Can't even stomach it. That's a tough thing. So, just hats off to the people who do the milers, 100-mile events. I mean, if you finish that, you've obviously just overridden that feeling of I can't eat something, and you've just made yourself eat something.
Your big toenail might fall off. I'm glad that you clarified. I'm glad you clarified that it's a lolly snake that you're eating, given our conversation about ultra runners running into snakes, real snakes.
Bring their knife and cook up the snake on the trail. Good.
So could I say that the achievement that you took home from this one was that, you know, the reward was learning that with your experience and all the other ultras you've run, that the value of that experience and putting a value now for yourself on the fact that you've done quite a number of ultra marathons, that with that knowledge there, that's actually a strength now for you. And you've actually seen, because you are required to rely as your biggest strength on your knowledge. And you realized, you know, you probably factor that in. You know, now if you can find a time for a big event, you know, the GAO 100 or whatever's coming up, you can take that into your mental bank and you go there and you say, you know, in the same way as if you're getting nervous the weekend before something you're going to do that's going to be quite hard, you say, I'm going to remember, you rely on your training, remember what you've done. You know, now you can actually take that as another, you know, and another mental tool in the kit to say, all right, I've got my experience. Don't forget, I've got that experience.
Totally. And there's so much carryover from what you do in your weekend warrior endurance events to working life and family life and all the other aspects of your life. It changes your mindset. If you can go in there and say, well, this is really difficult and it's worth it. I've got a goal. I'm going to achieve the goal. And you override and put the effort in and don't just go with what's easy. It's easy to quit. And you've done a big effort there and you've overridden all those urges to quit. It does change your mindset going into the next week. It's really important. It's not just about the event. And who cares? No one knows you're even there. Family know you're there. Let someone know before you go. It's always a good idea, but no one cares. I mean, it's really about us and what we get out of it, right?
Yeah, we've all had the kids come up and say,
"Did you win?
Are you gonna win? Did you win?"
Yeah, so you just say yes.
No. The top athlete in the country won that one. So,
and because they're so spread out, it's because there's such an obvious difference between first and last place in terms of hours and in endurance. Even in the Commonwealth Games are on at the moment, and even with the endurance events there in the triathlon, you watch it, and everyone's just within 1% of each other, or maybe a little bit more. But then that 1% spreads out into physical distance on the track, and it doesn't do justice to the caliber of athlete who came last in the Commonwealth Games triathlon to actually just look at it on face value and see where they finished. So it's at the amateur level, at the recreational athlete level. I mean, what you got to ask yourself, why are you doing these things? And you're not going to go unless you've got an answer to that. I mean, this is the perennial question, isn't it? Why do you do what you, like, why are you going to do the Fraser Nate Challenge this year? You've done it before. Why not you're done there.
One reason is that I signed up for it now.
Yeah, so you paid the money.
I've got a problem. I guess that's not a, that's an interesting thing though. That's not really an excuse, because you can unsign up for something easily. And as you say, nobody will know. But for a lot of us out there, the allure in terms of signing up for things is that you know that through stubbornness or commitment or whatever the factor is for you, you know that you'll make some stuff happen. And the making of the stuff happen over that period, you know, the finding the time with your busy life, with your kids, pulling out that time in the schedule to do something which is proven to make you a happier, healthier person, is for me one of the main benefits of doing this stuff. And I've found with events, sometimes the scarier goals are more motivating for that sort of stuff. Something you know is going to be pretty painful if you don't do it, or you potentially can't even do something out there for things if you don't get out there and if you don't do, you know, some work and some preparation, things like that. You potentially, as you say it, make other people's life hard by having to scrape you off the course or whatever it is.
Mm.
So with those in mind, the motivation towards a goal has always been a big one for me. I was always a bit intrigued by Fraser Nate, because when I moved to Launceston, some of the people who were winning it were all training out of here, although I was doing my PhD at the time and I couldn't really train at the level of them. But I was surrounded by that, you know, it's when you're surrounded by the greatness of the people winning, it is inspirational to see people who are, it's inspirational to see in any endeavor, people who in their chosen endeavor are working as hard as they possibly can and are dedicated and are clearing out other distractions and discomforts and things like that. And just to see anyone in any endeavor focusing at their top level is always inspirational, which should be anyway.
Mm.
To you know, for you, that there's someone doing it, you know, doing everything they can to achieve a goal. That's good to see. So there's a few reasons in terms of that. It's certainly a very, very, very picturesque part of the world too, and a lot of fun.
So getting out there into that amazing environment and doing it with like-minded people, and then having that inspiration from the top level of the field and all the camaraderie with everyone in the event as well.
Yeah, that course is Cloverleaf too. So me as a mid-packer and the people, you know, so I was riding out in my time trial last year at the same time as the top female, you know, so stuff like that is nice. So because you... until they ride off on you, you get to be sort of side by side with the elite, and that's...
I stood next to the winner of the Yu Yang's 50 at the starting line. It was
there. Good. You go, and as you know,
right there with them.
These people, it's not a sort of a fanboy type feeling. It's the, you know, this is great to see someone who's really good at this thing that you enjoy doing as a hobby.
It's very leveling, isn't it? So
it's nice. Yeah.
Unlike most events, you really can't, there's normally this sort of subculture. It's a smaller field, and you can expect to have time and have an audience with, and, you know, run alongside for a short amount of time, people who are very elite, and you can learn a lot from, which you don't get in a big city marathon or potentially in different grades of sport where the A team plays and then you're in your team and you might be in the A team. You don't see everybody at every level, every time. So you know what we were going to talk about today? And we promised last time we were going to talk about some of the training specifics for Freycinet that's coming up. I think I've done a very unorthodox race report from the Yu Yangs. It certainly hasn't been about elite performance, but we had a bunch of interesting topics that came out of it. Should we talk about the next part of this, which is your training for the non-running parts of the Freycinet Challenge?
Yeah, well, it's interesting the difference between ultra training and triathlon and multi-sport training. And I'm certainly not an expert and probably not even that good at these techniques of training. I've certainly made some mistakes over the years, but I have heard, you know, tips and things like that off some of the people who are elite, having been around for a little while. That's one of the advantages of getting older. You have met more people in your life. And one of the interesting differences between, say, pure running training, if we were going to try and train our bodies to do 10 hours of running in a weekend or more, compared to doing multi-sport things, one of the big ones, I think, of course, there's the need to go fast in multiple disciplines. So the need to practice them, that brings in, for the family people and for everybody, really, that brings in the challenges of time. In terms of time to get the training done, you know, multiple activities, whereas, you know, if you train, if someone side by side is training for a single event compared to training for three disciplines or four disciplines, there's going to be a difference in what they're going to do. Of course, I have always wondered whether an advantage to that. I was bigger when I put on weight during my studies and things when I started in 2018, when I started coming back towards this. I was weighed in at about 115 kilograms, which I don't know what is in pounds, but it's up there for someone who's 6 foot. And I had done a lot of weightlifting previously. So there was a lot of muscle in that and a lot of fat. And so I had, the point of sharing that was I'd wondered whether doing, say, a bike ride one day, a run that afternoon, as opposed to doing the 5 hours. Yeah, so 5 hours of training made up of two different things. I had always wondered whether that had been an advantage in terms of injury prevention, as opposed to if just kind of starting late and overweight, had late in life and a bit overweight, had gone into that one discipline. Don't know, it depends. It certainly, there's a lot of individual factors in that. I'd hoped that that was an advantage. Let's put it that way. I'd hoped that injury prevention might have been an advantage to, you know, as a repayment for the extra time that was required to set up a bike and then set up a kayak and that sort of stuff.
So spreading rather than doing one sport. So they're sort of hedging your bets and spreading the time of the base building period around multiple sports. And the other thing about cycling and paddling is that you don't have the impact of running. And if you think about a muscle contraction, you're shortening muscles. And where you often injure muscles is where they're being lengthened or repetitively pounded. So it's usually during high intensity running, for example, you get hamstring strains, but we're talking about slower stuff. You just have a lot more impact with the ground in running. And so what about when you're heavier and you've got you're building a cycling base? I mean, cycling's a great way to shred down. Yeah. Is that helpful? Like, because sometimes you can, when you're just doing running, unless you're really looking at your diet, it can be and if you're not doing any weights training as well, it can be disappointingly slow way of losing weight, of just running, especially in middle age as well. You shred down when you're young, sort of shred down at any, doing anything at all. But you sort of you have to tune everything up to then lean down when you're running, but add in the cycling. And I found you, it just accelerates the, you know, you're getting lean.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I can't talk to the science of all of this. The only thing I would say as well, though, is, you know, a human being getting on a two-wheel cycle is an extremely efficient form of transport. You know, it just takes your leg, you know, half your body and some food. And the bike, you know, yeah, I mean, it is designed to make a human pedal along very efficiently. So those training rides, I mean, it gives you the ability, it gave me the ability when I didn't have a base built up of endurance or an endurance background to go out for those hour and a half workouts, go out for those periods of time, as you're saying, without getting injured. And so in terms of, yeah, shedding down through kilos of fat or whatever it is, the ability to go and get, you know, a 30-kilometer ride starting or a 50-kilometer ride in and get that in that hour, 2 hour period, and then still out there seeing the sights. I couldn't at the start have done that of running.
Running takes
a while to build up to that sort of stuff. And yes, the pace of the cycling won't be a match for someone who's a really good cyclist, a really strong cyclist, I should say, when someone's starting out. But when someone's starting out, that's probably, you know, that doesn't matter, does it? It's you're building, and for many people, the start of that journey is the funnest part as well. It's the part, you know, you're building up into this thing, and you're getting back out there and learning about things, and going to bike shops or running shops, and they're giving you tips, and you've never heard of it all. They say, "Oh no, you know, try." There's a wide form of running shoes now. Oh wow, I had no idea.
It's exciting having the learning curve and all the goals and the excitement of the possibility of everything that's you can do. But then there's a plateau with anything where you've, you know, if it's the fourth, fifth year, perhaps you've been doing these events. That's why I've got a respect for people who have done, you know, had long careers in any sport, because you've not only got been able to get up there through that exciting phase and build up. It's a bit like anything. You get to that point where maintaining it is equally challenging, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Last year, the first year I did it, and I suppose last year, because of the break with 2020, it was probably some of my highest motivations to train and get out there, a really big block. This year, with other work and life stuff, hasn't been as much. You know, I'm still starting to ramp up. But to tackle that, if you're interested, I've done a couple of things. One of them is recently I've decided I had a very consistent, I was all about consistency in 2021, and I had my, you know, I had a good outcome. I was third in the 40-year-old category in my target A race, you call it. And then that meant, though, from the family perspective, which is one thing you and I like to talk about, it's on this podcast, from the perspective of balancing my wife's business and work, because she's a busy lady, and our young family, that took much more of a toll, because it meant, like, from 3 or 4 months out, I was already doing pretty high training, extremely high training loads, and for how busy I was and what I do in life and stuff. So this year I guess to get around that, I've sort of trying to more ramp into it. So June, you know, May was here, June was getting a bit more, July got a bit more. So looking at the little maps and things on your Strava for whatever they're worth, you can definitely see like the increase and increasing towards the event. And it's much easier. It's much easier for my partner, my wife, to kind of see, okay, we're moving towards that event. I know it's then. I know you take it seriously, but you haven't been out the rest of the year, just abandoned ship. That was one thing that to try and work with motivation. And the second thing, which I'll just quickly touch on, was in terms of the kayaking. We're flat water here in Launceston, and it's getting a bit burnt out with that, a bit bored. You know, did a lot of kayaking last year. So I've gone a lesson I've seen from my daughter, who's a very good swimmer, and her swimming coaches, that was don't train, you know, there's no point, you know, training with bad technique. So
swimming. Yeah. So swimming hold. And we're, as you said, we're not coaches. We are. This is just a personal perspective that's hopefully going to resonate with a lot of people. But yeah.
When I heard that, I went, so I'm out there with my poor technique or whatever it is on my kayak, grinding away and going, I'm a bit burnt out for this. I'm like, here, that for me, it was an aha moment. So I said, I got my most stable kayak out and I put it up in a shed that the club, the kayaking club have, instead of my fastest one. The faster ones are often a bit tippier, a bit less stability, and narrower in the water. It all makes sense from a physics perspective. That's not rocket science, that stuff. So I got my very stable kayak up, and I've just spent the last probably month or more just working on technique, just by myself, no coaching or anything like that, just working on coaching techniques I've previously been given. And it's been good because I'm paddling my really, really, my slower boat, stable boat, trying to start pushing out up now to nearly as fast as I'd paddle a less stable boat, because I'm paddling a lot easier. And so my, the blades moving, the proper line through the water, just like swimming, there's a lot of technique involved in kayaking, and the technique where you hold your arms and how you move your body through and how you rotate your core, drive your legs to make, if you're just sitting there using your arms, tiny, tiny little arm muscles compared to your big core and your legs.
Getting that power driving through your leg and through all the muscles that connect the legs to the trunk and into the arm. Yeah.
So they're my two techniques that I've been using in a year of a lot of other stuff going on, which, takes the attention.
Here's the other thing is, if you're injured, a lot of people will then go and do things that they know they should be doing. And we all know what we should be doing, really. It's not knowledge that gets in the way of what we do. Most of the time, it's just the implementation or applying that knowledge, isn't it? Having time and everything. And so when you get injured, you often go back and you can't run or you can't do your sport. You often go back and dedicate yourself to all the things that you should be doing with mobility and technique, planning, diets, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But that's a good thing. And that can also, you don't have to be injured. You might be a part of your periodization. You might have some building weeks where it's high volume and everything, and in some lighter weeks, focusing on technique. You could make that argument for running, cycling, paddling, but probably mostly for swimming and paddling, right? Now, the technique is potentially a bigger factor in paddling, definitely in swimming, than it is in running. You can see all sorts of running techniques that can be effective. But if you have a dodgy paddling technique, stand still, right?
Yeah.
I know you do when you swim.
Not to downplay the importance of running technique or whatever.
No, not at all.
That's not where we're going. That's not where we're headed with that. But to say that in terms of efficiency and power, there are very big, so there are very big gains to be made.
Right.
For swimming and I don't know about swimming because I'm not a swimmer, but for kayaking at least. So, and I'm told for swimming as well. Swimming coaches, obviously having the right technique. And of course out there you can find examples of people who do the golf swing or whatever it is with the terrible technique and they're an amazing player. That's fine. But I'm not one of the people who get to sign up. I'm not one of the people generally in life who get to sign up for the unicorn status and get away with things. So for me, a bit of technique would probably help.
So having we've covered having goals and the importance of goals and our perspectives on goal setting, and then that led into performance from this episode. And we talked again about your training and cycling, paddling. You know what we should do next episode? Let's actually talk about measuring and monitoring progress in training. So there's so many different ways that we measure and monitor progress, from watches through to perceived effort. And we've been talking about some of them today. So there's some really nice training discussions we can have. So there's a topic for next time. And the other thing is some guests. Let's get some guests on here.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
We've got some good
friends
who do some crazy stuff that it would be really interesting to chat to. Perfect excuse. I mean, they're probably not going to do a half an hour Zoom with name anybody from the scene who's you know, unless there's a podcast, it's a great excuse for a catch up with them.
We might try to, but they might pretend they're busy and not available.
But you do a podcast and people love it. People say yes to podcasts. Oh yeah, I'll do that. I'll be on that. And then you've got yourself a chat and you hear things that you would never have heard in passing. So there's some crazy people we can get on here.
I've got someone in mind for our next episode, Luke, and it's the perfect person for everyday endurance.
Yeah, so good.
Someone in mind who can really speak to these challenges and the fun of balancing your family, your career, your other interests and your passion for doing fun endurance activities. So
perfect.
I think that's
that is a wrap, but you know what today is the thing. Yeah. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend. That's your call to action. There you go.
So we'll see you on the trails, tracks, roads, rivers, and even the oceans. Until next time, this is Luke and Simon Perrottin enjoying everyday endurance.